From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, years of coordinated corruption between FCA and the UAW.
Federal authorities go so far as to say that this was a corruption that was orchestrated by Fiat Chrysler as a company and by the United Auto Workers as a union institution.
Domestic abuse survivor Nicole Beverly taking her message to high schools.
The only way we can end this epidemic is with prevention and by teaching our young people how to avoid getting involved in an abusive relationship.
Life as a newspaper columnist and a TV reporter.
I can't talk when I'm cold, which is a real problem. I start stuttering. And so, yes, I have invested in winter wardrobe par excellence.
And the most important piece of correspondence I got in the almost 20 years that I worked in Detroit was from a man who said, I used to be a racist.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As I wrap up my time here on Stateside, I'm checking in with some past guests. Today, Nicole Beverly. Her ex-husband went to prison for stalking her, and then he threatened her life from behind bars. That propelled her to become an activist, working with lawmakers and police on behalf of domestic violence survivors. But first, the federal corruption probe into the United Auto Workers Union continues. The headlines keep coming. There have been FBI raids, indictments, convictions, top leaders resigning, bribes, kickbacks, misuse of union money. It's all in there. And now Detroit News business editor Daniel Howes and his colleague Robert Snell have pulled the threads together for their investigation titled Driven by Greed, Alliance of FCA Union Leaders Fueled Decade of Corruption. Daniel, take us into this alliance of FCA and union leaders. When and how did it begin, and what was the long game?
The long game ultimately became an attempted merger with General Motors. Fiat Chrysler chairman and CEO Sergio Marchionne was very keen on that, certainly in from about 2012 through 2015. But we trace this back. The first illegal payments to union people in the joint training center between the UAW and FCA came within weeks of the former Chrysler emerging from bankruptcy, flush with about $12.5 billion of yours and my money. And they then, this unspooled over time in the ensuing years. And what we've also found out is that there were other kind of rings, if you will, or nests of corruption that were going on the East Coast, in St. Louis, elsewhere in Detroit, ultimately out in California and Palm Springs. They weren't all necessarily related. The only thing that really related them all was that they were all UAW. But, you know, the core of what was going on here was Sergio Marchionne able to exploit, it looks like, able to exploit some corruption or corrupt intent within the union. And there are a lot of people that were enlisted in this. We're hearing more names with each passing week. Our understanding is the federal government and the federal authorities are getting more and more tips. Where those will lead, if anywhere, remains to be seen, of course.
It was stunning in your piece, as I see that prosecutors are alleging that this money was part of a broad attempt by Fiat Chrysler execs to get these labor concessions from the UAW to keep them, and I'm quoting here, fat, dumb, and happy.
That's exactly right. And that is the contention. And in fact, in some earlier pieces that we wrote, the federal authorities go so far as to say that this was a corruption that was orchestrated by Fiat Chrysler as a company and by the United Auto Workers as a union institution. That these were not just bad apples or quite a few bad apples within the organization, that it was systematic. Now, that has not been adjudicated, and it may never be, but that certainly is one of the allegations.
Did any of these bribery and kickback schemes, did any of this involve money from post-bankrupt GM?
You know, cash is fungible. So if these companies have gotten money from the U.S. taxpayers, and in the case of GM, it was close to $50 billion at one point, you know, you could make that argument. But yes, there were situations where GM money was used. It's important to make a distinction here, though. Early on in this, what we thought was that the money that was being disbursed in bribes and other kinds of things to members of the UAW was money that came from the joint training centers. And that comes from the companies and is a negotiated number every 4 years. And they decide essentially what a budget is and how much they can spend. And the union, President Dennis Williams at the time, when this first blew up, kept saying, there's no member dues money here. None has been implicated at all. This is all corporate training center money. Well, what we've subsequently found is this is unspooled at the federal level is that, in fact, they were using member dues. That's what was financing a lot of the expenses and the luxury items out in Palm Springs, for example, or renting luxury villas, poolside luxury villas, not for the 3 or 5 day conference, but for 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, in some cases, 8 weeks.
As I read your piece, something jumped out, and that was the fact you write that the corruption spanned at least 4 generations of UAW leaders, including what you call the junior varsity. Has this infiltrated to lower levels of union leadership?
Hard to know, frankly. You have situations here where regional people have been charged. We haven't gotten into really local leaders yet, to my knowledge. That doesn't mean it isn't happening or isn't likely to happen. Frankly, we don't know where this is. When we talked to U.S. Attorney Matthew Schneider before Thanksgiving, he at one point characterized this as kind of the beginning of the end of the middle, or, you know, it was kind of he was trying to channel Churchill or something in terms of where exactly we were in this whole thing. But I think clearly it's not over by any stretch. And, even if the former President Gary Jones and his predecessor Dennis Williams are charged, there are likely to be others who are charged. You get the impression. So, you know, this and in certain regions like Region 5 out in St. Louis, it's obvious that this has been going on for some period of time, and it was part of the culture there. Now, I think some of the ages of some of the people involved, they tend to be maybe a little bit older, but we don't also know who some of the other people that were involved.
As you dug through all those documents and records, you write for us and lay out a stunning ability of these union bosses to spend an astonishing amount of money. Give us a few of the expenses that really stood out to you.
Well, certainly Palm Springs is kind of in a class by itself, buying bottles of Cristal champagne, which on most wine lists are about $400 a piece, $200 retail, give or take, $60,000 in cigars, cigar cutters, ashtrays, fancy ashtrays, $2,000 sets of Titleist golf clubs, one of which was found in the garage of Gary Jones in suburban Detroit. There was a lot of real excess in that regard, I think. The other thing that struck me, and Rob did a lot of the work on some of this stuff, which is the numbers of the payouts. The number so far is there's been, I think it's about $34 million of illegal benefits have been accrued and collected by people affiliated with the union. The number per person was something like on the order of over $400,000. Now, when you compare this to other corruption cases in Southeast Michigan, and as a lot of your listeners know, this has been going on for some period of time. The most obvious example was the conviction of former Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick. Mm-hmm. But the amount of money that these guys were taking pales is it just makes all that other stuff look like chicken feed. So the UAW and the auto industry has taken this to a much higher level in terms of dollars and cents. And that, I think, is a reflection of the size of the industry, the amount of money that flows through it. I mean, these companies are, you know, General Motors is what, $150 billion probably in terms of annual revenue. Fiat Chrysler is less than that. But these are enormous amounts of money that flow through these companies. And so, you know, $34 million to the auto industry is a rounding error, frankly. It's not to other people, though. And if you're the one who's a recipient of some of that money, it can be sizable. I mean, in a couple of cases, we got into $1.5 million, $2 million. For one individual.
One thing that jumped out, 58,000 watches supplied by UAW VP's Joe Ashton's chiropractor, and they were delivered in January 2014. What the heck ever happened to 58,000 watches?
As far as we know, they're sitting in a Detroit warehouse. It's important to know, so a lot of your listeners may remember the airbag inflator scandal that greeted Mary Barra when she became CEO of General Motors.
Yes.
She had to contend with that. Well, those watches were ready for shipment, and they were supposed to be a marker of of what a great quality and vehicle quality GM had, and how the union and the company worked together, and this was supposed to commemorate that. Well, obviously the timing, and no pun intended, was terrible. And so the watches were never disbursed and given out to anybody, and they're still sitting in a warehouse, presumably their battery's dead, just sitting there. It kind of reminds you, evokes this vision of, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark at the end, you know, where you've got this long storage room, and it, somewhere at the back are watches that have a UAW logo on them.
How did this go on so merrily for so long until the feds got tipped off?
Well, the federal authorities talk about a culture of corruption or a culture of alcohol. Clearly, this was something that had been going on for some period of time. In talking with the feds, we've asked them about that. And they say, look, we went back to the beginning, to 2009. That was the emergence from bankruptcy was a good place to start in this whole thing. But there, I think there's a belief that a lot of this stuff had been going on for a very long time. Now, I think it probably warped and woofed depending on who were players and who were not. I mean, one person that we identified for the first time in our package this week was a guy by the name of Jim Wells, who was the head of Region 5 based in St. Louis. He was infamous in auto circles for being a very difficult guy to work with, but he was also infamous in union circles and was depicted as someone who taught people how to essentially do this. And a lot of the individuals who have been charged and in some cases convicted in this whole thing came out of Region 5, including, I might add, UAW President Gary Jones, who just resigned. He was the deputy of Jim Wells. Now, Jim Wells died in 2012, and Gary Jones took his place until he became the president of the UAW in June of 2018. But Region 5 was the region that was sponsoring these conferences every year out in Palm Springs because California was part of the region. It was the largest geographic region in the UAW, 17 states. The new president, Rory Gamble, has now blown it up. Mm-hmm. And is now separating it and essentially hiving it off between two different regions, one based in Chicago and the other in Tennessee, which strikes me as a situation where they're trying to get their arms around or break up whatever may be going on in that region and bring a little bit more rigor to it. And in fact, the two regional heads of those two other regions are considered to be pretty straight shooters.
Well, it is a tremendous feat of reporting, and there's so much in this package, including a lot of interactive web things. I do encourage people to check out at DetroitNews.com, Driven by Greed, from Daniel Howes and Robert Snell. Daniel Howes, thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you.
Coming up, we check in with Nicole Beverly, the woman who endured years of abuse, stalking, and threats from her ex-husband, including threats made while he was in prison. That is next here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As I retire, I'm thinking of the thousands of interviews that I have done here on Stateside. And I really wanted to check in on some of the people whose stories really stayed in my heart. Nicole Beverly is one of those people. In June 2017, she was on this program sharing her story, years of abuse at the hands of her ex-husband, Kevin Beverly. And while he was serving 5 years in prison on a 2012 aggravated stalking conviction, Nicole got some terrifying news.
Two inmates came forward at Jackson Prison writing letters stating that my ex-husband was on a regular basis saying that as soon as he got out, he was going to come to my home and kill my children in front of me.
Nicole alleges her ex-husband made four attempts to hire others to kill her and her two sons. Kevin Beverly was later convicted of crimes that could keep him in prison until at least 2030. Let's see how things are faring now for Nicole and her sons. Nicole Beverly, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
It's really good to see you. You know, I just could not let go of your story, and I want to thank you for coming back to talk with us, talk with me one last time before I retire. First of all, tell us, what is the latest on your ex-husband?
At this point in time, he is still incarcerated. He is being housed in Saginaw, and he still has two appeals that are at the Supreme Court level. Basically, he's asking for a new jury trial in Washtenaw County, and he's asking to withdraw his plea in Wayne County on two of the cases that he was, you know, initially pled guilty to and then was found guilty in Washtenaw County.
Because between these new cases, he could be in prison until, what, at least about 2030?
Correct, yes. His original sentence was 13 to 35 years in prison with his time served. So it already feels like it's kind of going quickly to me because 10 years.
Wow.
You know, yeah. The clock's already ticking. And now the appeal's kind of just hanging over my head still give me a feeling of uneasiness because I just, you know, have had so many negative experiences with the legal system, the judicial system, that I just never feel 100% secure that things are going to go fine.
I remember, Nicole, when we first talked in 2017, you were really close to picking up and moving out of Michigan, but you stayed. Why?
I stayed. The main reason that I stayed was the Attorney General's office agreed to pick up my case after a lot of hard work by a lot of people basically asking them to do that, to step in and try to protect myself and my family.
And of course, that was Attorney General Bill Schuette.
Yes, correct. Yep. Mm-hmm. Attorney General Bill Schuette and his amazing team that represented me. And we ended up winning the case. He was convicted by jury in Washtenaw County. So that was the reason that I decided to stay at least long enough for my youngest son to graduate from high school. So he's a sophomore now. And also to give myself some time to reestablish my new name and social security number and build a little bit of history before I am forced to relocate.
Because you feel that day is going to come.
Absolutely. You know, at this point in time, for the most part, criminals, people that are incarcerated, serve their minimum sentence unless something very dramatic or traumatic happens during their incarceration. So I fully anticipate that he will be released in 10 years and that I will not be able to be here where he can find me when that happens.
Nicole, the thing that I still just stuck with me was the central part of what was going on, that he was inside, and you believe trying to get someone somehow to kill you, making threats while he was still incarcerated. Is there any reason to think that is still a threat to you?
I think me being trying to be positively naive, I try not to think about it. But the reality is he's already attempted to hire 5 different individuals at 3 different correctional facilities to kill myself and my children, that I don't think it is unreasonable to believe that he is still attempting to do that where he's at now. And he was very specific in his methods of how he was going to have these people kill me. And it is definitely a possibility. I try, you know, I'm still very aware of my surroundings at all times. My children are too. So I don't know that I'll ever be able to truly let my guard down in life. But I also try not to live in fear because a life lived in fear would have no joy.
That's a tough balancing act.
Absolutely.
You've been involved now in advocacy work. This
Absolutely.
Has kind of launched you into this and also lobbying and also speaking to high school. So I want to explore that. Let's start with what you've been doing, Nicole Beverly, in terms of getting legislation passed to protect domestic violence survivors. You certainly bring powerful insight when you go talk to people in Lansing. So what's going on?
So in Lansing, the most exciting development has been with the address confidentiality bill, which would essentially protect victims of domestic violence, stalking, and sexual assault by giving them a P.O. box that is protected. Their mail would be sent there and then distributed to them by the staff that is managing that program. Now, the bill was introduced initially by Senator O'Brien in 2017, and unfortunately, with the election happening and other what they felt were more pressing issues, the bill basically died. And it was reintroduced by Senator Jeff Irwin and Ruth Johnson.
So you've got bipartisan on this.
Yes, which is excellent to have bipartisan support. And Senator Pete Lucido actually had a big role in getting it in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee after another survivor. And I, Ashton, still went and met with him. And he did what he said he would do, and he did get the bill in front of the committee in October. And several survivors and I went and spoke, and it passed that level. And now it is awaiting House committee approval. And I'm fully anticipating that it will move forward and will pass, and then we can hopefully get it out onto the House floor and speak again and get a vote in favor of it beginning to protect more victims.
And there's also Senate Bill 257, sponsored by Democratic Senator Stephanie Chang. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so Senator Chang has been amazing in terms of her advocacy for victims of domestic violence and stalking. And the bill that she introduced was actually signed into law just in November. And that bill was written to basically correct the wording in a law that established that anyone who had a deferred domestic violence charge would count as a prior conviction, so if they're charged again. So when we say deferred, basically what happens in most first offense domestic violence cases, people are given probation. And if they serve their probation and there are no issues, their charge essentially goes away. And that is a very real thing, and it happens in almost all first-time offenses. Now, if that person in the past were to have a second or third offense, that a deferred charge would not show up. So basically what this bill does is it's going to allow for those deferred cases to now show up.
So and it turns up the legal heat.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a step in the right direction in terms of sentencing. You know, that's another big issue that I've had in terms of our sentencing guidelines in general with domestic violence. So it is absolutely a step in the right direction.
If you've just tuned in, I'm speaking with Nicole Beverly. She's the Michigan mother who endured years of abuse, stalking, and threats from her ex-husband, Kevin, including threats that she said were made while he was in prison. He is still there after being convicted in 2018 of more crimes. He is appealing these convictions, but he could be held till at least 2030. And Nicole is one of the people I most wanted to catch up with before I retire from Stateside. Let's talk about the work you're doing in high schools. What's the importance of getting into those classrooms and talking to those kids?
Yeah, I am a true believer that the only way we can end this epidemic is with prevention and by teaching our young people how to avoid getting involved in an abusive relationship in the first place. Without the knowledge base of what red flags to look out for, I didn't know. I was one of those people who did not grow up in an abusive household, and I had no idea what type of red flags to look out for. And currently, most high schools are not having these conversations with our students. So I go into high schools, and I'm now doing a pre and post survey before I do my presentation to basically gather more information and data and talk to them about the red flags. I share my story. I share stories of other survivors and teach them in an active way what the red flags are, what to do if you find yourself in an abusive relationship, what to do if you have a friend that is in an abusive relationship. And what's been very startling to me with the pre-surveys that I'm doing is in many cases, a third to a half of these students have already themselves or one of their friends in the same age group been in an emotionally and or physically abusive relationship.
These are kids.
And 16 to 24 is the age when you're most likely to become involved in your first domestic violence relationship. So to me, without providing them with this education, we are never going to stop this epidemic from occurring because they're not going to have the knowledge. And after that, all we're going to do is put Band-Aids on situations as they happen.
You know, as we're talking, give parents who are listening a sense. What are the do's and don'ts, especially when you're talking about teenagers who don't want to talk about their lives to you anyway, mm-hmm. but what should parents be doing?
So I've actually had several parents reach out to me after my presentations and their kids coming home and having these conversations with them for the first time ever. I think parents need to have these conversations. It might not feel natural. People might not even think about having them. But, you know, the parents that have reached out to me afterwards were so thankful because they knew something was happening, but they didn't know what was happening until their children came home and said, this is what I learned today. This is what has been happening in my life. I'm going to end this relationship. And, you know, the parents were very grateful. But I think as parents, we don't think about having these conversations, but we have to be having them with our young people. What is a healthy relationship? What does a healthy relationship look like? What are the red flags of abuse? What do you do if, you know, you sense them in your relationship? And it is happening with our young people in high school.
Oh, well, for a teenage girl, what we would recognize as stalking, controlling behavior, if it's your first boyfriend, you don't know. You're right. Oh, he loves me and he cares about me and he wants to know where I am all the time.
Absolutely. And you know, technology, social media has really changed the game in terms of the way abusers can now control their victims, keep track of them, monitor their every move, which is terrifying.
Nicole Beverly, you're also advocating for changes in law enforcement and policing when it comes to domestic violence calls. So especially in Washtenaw County, there's steps that are happening. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. I'm absolutely thrilled at the progress that we've made in this direction, especially. I've been a part of the Legislative Policy Committee with Safe House and the Washtenaw County Sheriff's Department for the better part of 2 years. And one of the most important things I wanted to accomplish was having lethality assessments.
And what is that?
So a lethality assessment is essentially an 11 to 13 question assessment that an officer does when they are responding to a domestic violence call. And the questions are specifically designed to assess the victim's risk for being killed by their abuser. And when an officer is responding to a domestic violence call, they will go through the questions with the victim in private.
In private.
In private. Yeah. Very, very important, because the victim will never answer honestly if their abuser is within earshot. And once they have the answers to those questions, they basically assign a lethality risk to that victim. That assessment would then be attached to the police report, be seen by the prosecutor, and then also noted when it goes before the judge when they're deciding on bond for the abuser if they are arrested.
So it's a way of getting this narrative right into things from the very beginning. Give me an example.
So, for example, there were many times that I called the police and didn't get great response, unfortunately, a few years ago. And so rather than a police officer coming in, doing just their basic investigation technique, which in some cases for me involved being asked what I did to cause my abuser to stalk me and harass me, or making light of a situation and making assumptions, the officer will automatically now ask these questions. And some of the questions might involve, is there a weapon in the home? Has this person attempted to strangle you before? Because that is the number one predictor for homicide in domestic violence cases, is if your abuser has attempted to strangle you before, the likelihood of you being killed by them is the greatest. So questions like that, which are then rated and talked to with the victim by the officer as well of, you are at great risk if you stay in this situation of being killed by your partner.
And so you're opening the eyes of the victim as well. Much the way you talked about with talking to these young people in schools, these questions could open a door in someone's mind.
Absolutely. And the officers that I've spoken to that are doing it in other states have found that to be one of the most powerful aspects of the tool, is that the victim, maybe for the first time ever, realizes the real risk that they're facing if they stay in the relationship.
What would it take to get this beyond Washtenaw County and into counties all through Michigan?
Well, so Washtenaw County voted. My goal initially was to just have Washtenaw County Sheriff's Department begin using these assessments. But things kind of snowballed in a great way this time. And all of the chiefs for Washtenaw County, so everybody, Ann Arbor, IPSC, even the universities, will have voted to go ahead and move forward with using these assessments. The training video is in production right now. And Arianne Slay, who was one of my prosecutors, who's now running for prosecutor in 2020, is having a huge role in the development of the training protocol for the officers. So once the video is complete and rolled out, we're looking at starting the assessments somewhere between January and March of 2020. And then the goal is to collect enough data and show effectiveness where we can push for statewide legislation so that every department in Michigan will then begin using the lethality assessments.
And your story is also going to have a broader reach, a movie?
It is. So what I can share about the movie that I'm very, very excited about is that I've optioned to do a film, and it is going to be based on my true life story with producer Harley Wallen. His production company is Painted Creek Productions, and I'm very excited about the project because it's not only going to give the opportunity to share my story, it's my opportunity to share every victim's story and to really showcase to people how you can fall in love with someone who ends up almost killing you. And so I'm thrilled to have this opportunity.
Giving your story and everything you've been through that wider platform, and as you say, the whole mission is to keep this from happening.
Absolutely.
Well, I wish you the best of luck as you proceed with all of this advocacy. And again, you are one of the people that I've met of the thousands of interviews that I've done on Stateside where you really stay close to my heart. And I really appreciate you coming in and bringing us all up to date on what you're doing. And I wish you the very, very best of everything.
Thank you. It means so much to me that you thought of me. I'm so honored that, you know, you invited me to come and interview with you, you know, during your last few weeks.
Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you.
Still to come, we check in with two more of my favorite stateside guests and friends, Rochelle Riley, former Detroit Free Press columnist, and Mara McDonald with Detroit's NBC affiliate, WDIV. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, this is my final week as host of Stateside and my final week of 40 years in radio and TV in Michigan. I'm retiring to spend more time with the grandkids and at our cottage in West Cork, Ireland. Before that happens, I am taking the opportunity to talk with some of my favorite guests and friends. I've got this image of a dinner party where you open a good bottle of wine and people just start talking about anything and everything. So today's dream dinner party guests are two women well known by readers and TV viewers in Michigan. I know them also as friends and traveling buddies. Rochelle Riley, longtime Detroit Free Press columnist, author of the book The Burden, African Americans and the Enduring Impact of Slavery. These days, she is Detroit's Director of Arts, Culture, and Entertainment. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you here. TV audiences in Southeast Michigan know her as lead reporter on WDIV Local 4, the NBC affiliate in Detroit. I have known her since my days as a TV anchor and reporter in Detroit. I've always admired her take-no-prisoners approach to TV news reporting and her amazing collection of hats and coats for those 11 o'clock live shots in the middle of a cold Michigan winter. Mara McDonald, welcome to Stateside.
Do you know that it's 30 years? I've known you for 30 years.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, because you hadn't even launched, you were starting to your TV career, and you were an assignment editor on the weekends when we were at WKBD-TV, and you were looking for that first thing.
For a break.
And you got it, and here you are.
And here we are 30 years later.
Wow. Look at us, ladies. I love it. Thank you for coming to my studio dinner party. I'm sorry that we can't open wine, but we know how to pretend we're having good
wine.
We
better pretend, or we'd have to open three bottles.
Yeah. And they would all be finished.
Yes.
So I want people to get to know these women that they know, they think they know, from the Free Press, from Local 4. I'm going to start, Rochelle. When you were a school kid growing up in North Carolina, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Exactly what I'm doing. I wanted to be a writer. And I spent years trying to figure out how to feed myself doing it. So when I discovered journalism, that was it.
So writing came first.
Yes.
And then journalism, it sounded like, oh, I can actually make a paycheck?
Junior year of high school, and there was one little high school in my little town. I've told you this story before. Tarboro, North Carolina, 10,000 people there when I grew up, 10,000 people there now. And in our lone high school, the English teacher decided my junior year that she would teach a news writing class because she thought it would be fun. And the principal let her have some news writing textbooks. And I said, holy cow, this is how I can make money.
Boom.
That was it.
And you did.
That was it.
And you were a reporter. Before you came to Detroit, you had kind of trucked around in the newspapering business.
I went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where I studied journalism, worked in Greensboro, Dallas, in Washington at the Post, in Fort Worth, Texas, in Louisville, Kentucky. I didn't become a columnist until I was on the ladder to be an editor. And I realized that I was not raising my daughter. I adopted a little girl when she was 2 years old, and I was never seeing her because I was a manager and I was constantly doing things. And I was on a business trip and called in just to say hi, and her nanny said, I need to tell you, I made a burger and fries for her for dinner. And she looked at it with her eyes real big and said, I didn't know you could get this at home.
Ooh.
And I went back the next day and quit. And they said, no, please don't quit. And I said, then I have to do something else. I cannot, I don't want to be a publisher. I don't want to be an editor. I need to be a mom.
So the columnist position let you be a mom and still have your, and have your voice and write for the
Best
Free Press.
Best job I ever had.
There you go. Mara, growing up in Oakland County, what did little Mara dream of being?
Well, little Mara grew up in a home with a father who was off the boat from Eastern Europe and a mother who was ahead of her time as far as smarts and power. And in my house, you grew up with the Free Press every day, and you grew up watching the local news and then the national news every night over dinner. So little Mara with no math skills.
Something we have in common.
Oh, amen to that. That makes three of us.
with no math skills, but pretty good writer and an ability to speak usually relatively well, tried to maximize her limited skill set and went to college for political science, always knowing that I was going to try TV news. Didn't know if I was going to be successful, but I had the kind of parents who said, you might as well try it. So let's see if you can make this happen.
And I can hear their voices saying that because, you know what, support from families is awfully important. I had a husband when I landed the first radio job, it was 1 a.m. to 8 a.m., 6 mornings a week for $180 a week.
The glamour shift.
The glamour shift. But I got a chance to learn on the air in Detroit. But I went home and I had to start that next morning. I got the offer at 4:30 in the afternoon. He said, can you come in at 1 in the morning? And I went, yeah, okay. And when I told my husband, well, guess what? And I'd been working at a nonprofit. This is what I'm making. Bless his heart. He went, well, okay then. And he started clipping coupons.
God bless Sean Canty.
Sean Canty is the best.
He still, you know, when you think TV news, Mara, there's this perception that it is exciting, glamorous, and it can be. But what would the people who watch you at night be surprised to know about what it's like to do your job?
I think that people would be surprised at how heavy the lift can be some days. I think people just think you stand there and talk.
Like you just swan in and
it all just sort of happens, except it's not how it works. And I will tell you, there has been a real run lately of some pretty heavy on your heart kind of stories. And I think I compartmentalize pretty well because if you can't, you can't do this. But there was a couple weeks span there where I thought to myself, I got to have a couple days off because I need to take this off my shoulder. You can only see somebody else's pain and misery so often before it starts to eat away.
I remember
you.
I would be in team mode doing the story, you know, standing in front of the burned out house where a family had died because of some horrific fire, and there would be the balloons and the teddy bears behind, and you are looking in the camera and you are being professional, and then you go back to the news station, say goodbye to everybody, get in the car and cry all the way home. That was my big MO when I was doing TV news. And as a columnist, you got to do something different, Rochelle, because as a reporter, you're not supposed to take a position. You are neutral. You are absorbing information and giving it. How did it feel to be able to own a voice and speak out about the things that bothered you?
It was absolute freedom. I didn't mind the constraints because I liked being a reporter, because I liked being able to tell stories. And there's no such thing as objectivity. There is an attempt to be balanced and to try and give people a full picture. As a columnist, I don't have to do anything except tell you how I feel, what I think, and what I think is wrong. And I literally was born for that.
But you then open yourself up to people who thoroughly disagree with that. Is that a hard thing when somebody slams back at something that you've poured your heart into writing?
I can tell you right now, being a columnist is not a job for either the faint at heart or anyone who's thin-skinned. I have very thick skin, and I certainly don't mind going toe-to-toe with people, even crazy people, and some of them are crazy. But I have learned so much from people who have different opinions. We've had conversations that are grown-up conversations about why I feel a certain way and why they feel a certain way. And the most important piece of correspondence I got in the almost 20 years that I worked in Detroit was from a man who said, I used to be a racist.
You wrote a great column on that.
It was stunning to me. I cried. My boss framed it for me so I would have it. And it wasn't so much that I changed his mind. It was that he changed my mind about him because the conversations that we had meant something. Sometimes you feel a certain way or do certain things because it's what you know. It's what you were taught. It's what you grew up with. Just sometimes talking to each other can mean all the difference in the world.
How about in your role, you get, give us a typical day. How many, you come in at what time? Tell people what, you talk about a heavy lift.
Maura comes in at midnight and gets off at midnight, right?
There are days that it feels that way. No, I come in at 2:30 and I get out about midnight. But my day really starts when I wake up because I want to see, has anybody emailed me? Do I have any texts? Do I have to respond to anything immediately? Are there any stories percolating? Do I need to call the newsroom? I have some tenure in this town. I've been at Channel 4 for 16 years. Lord have mercy. I have an advantage that I've been around a while, and people tend to call people that they know and trust and say, hey, did you hear this? Do you know this is coming? So, I'm not trying to say that I'm some sort of a martyr or I work harder than anybody else, but, I mean, it's a job that is, I think, like being at the paper or being on the radio. It's a 24-hour cycle, and you have to be vigilant because when you're not, and it's the day that you haven't washed your hair for 2 days, you have no makeup on, and you're in your cruddy blue robe, and, an underwear bomber tries to blow up a plane over Metro. So, I am perpetually prepared for something to happen.
Always right. Well, and you are even in your wardrobe. And that was one of my big memories when I went from hosting a public affairs TV show or years in a radio studio like this. And then I started doing this dirt reporting. And there's a wonderful veteran reporter at Channel 7 in Detroit, Mary Conway. And I was new on the street and she looked at me and she said, piece of advice, invest in coats. No one's going to see what you got underneath, but you're going to be standing outside. That audience is going to see your coats. Invest in coats. And, that the physical demands, when you're standing out there at 11 o'clock, and I know you've got a couple coats that make it look like you're North Pole bound, but you need to be. You have to stand out there.
I can't talk when I'm cold, which is a real problem. I start stuttering. And so, yes, I have invested in winter wardrobe par excellence. You can keep me out there at about minus 20, and then maybe I start getting chilly. I've got this thing dialed up. And my dad has been buying me parkas, too, because he says, you look cold.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking with TV news reporter Maura McDonald, who's with WDIV Local 4, Detroit's NBC affiliate, and with Rochelle Riley, who is now the Director of Arts, Culture, and Entertainment for the City of Detroit. Before that, she was an award-winning, longtime columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Why'd you leave the Free Press?
It was time. I had planned to leave at the end of the year because I said, if I'm going to do something else, I better go ahead and do it.
And you had your book, The Burden Was Out.
I had the book. Yeah. It did very well. It's still like in the top 10 bestsellers in Michigan, which is stunning. But I left early because we were having layoffs at the paper and they were looking at laying off 11 people and people were trying to volunteer and they were trying to figure out, what was going to happen. And it was a very sad time. And I went to the editor and I said, if I leave, what will that mean for the numbers? And at first he said, well, we're not supposed to tell you not to leave, but you really don't really want to leave, right? I mean, you have so much. I said, do you have any idea how old I am or what else I'm capable of? And he didn't. And I said, if I'm going to do something else, I need to do it. Otherwise, I'll be here for the next 20 years. And I have some other stuff I want to do. So let me know about the numbers. And 6 o'clock that evening of the deadline day, he said, if you take it, I don't have to lay anybody off. I said, I'm out.
And you saved some jobs.
I did.
And now you're working at City Hall.
Can you believe it?
I cannot. What's your mission? What's the job?
I have two things. I actually have three things. The first is to transform the way that we across Metro Detroit see Detroit arts. They're some of the most brilliant people and amazing programs that don't get the attention they deserve. I'm talking world-class talent and geniuses who make most of their money and their stature outside of our city. I need to let people know about that. And since I used to write a column and try to convince people of things, I think I can do that. And the second thing is to make sure that there's support. The city didn't have this office. So this is new. I'm building something from scratch, which means I have to build something that will last or I will have failed. So I have to build something that will last, that will support artists and arts programs and cultural programs and historians for the next 100 years.
That sounds pretty fun, doesn't it?
Is that all?
Mara, who's your hero or your role model?
That's a very, very hard question to answer because I don't have a single role model. But I will tell you that people that I have been surrounded by, as well as, you know, those that I haven't, that are more intangible. For example, when you and I worked together, and I was all of, you know, 21, 22 years old, I had the fire in the belly, and I knew what I wanted to do. But, you know, it's like a sponge. A kid is like a sponge, mm-hmm. and you suck in everything from the people around you. And I watched you, and I watched you write, and I watched how you treated people with respect, even if you thought they were awful. You always made people feel, even if you thought they were incredibly wrong or revolting, that they were welcome to talk to you and that you were there. And your gift of writing is something that I think is dying in television. And I'm really glad that I got to see that up close and personal.
Oh, gosh, thanks. Do you see yourselves? I never saw myself as a woman in the field. I saw myself as somebody trying to do the best job my boss wanted me to do.
Same.
How about you guys?
Yeah. Same. I never... to me, it wasn't a gender thing. And quite frankly, I think there's something egalitarian about being in the field as a television reporter, because I don't think anybody's really interested in whether you're a woman or a man or what color your skin is or whatever. Can you get it done?
And do it right and do it accurately.
Correct.
And quickly.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for me, it was a little different only because of the times that I worked in and the fact that there weren't many African-American reporters when I was starting out. And the bottom line was you represented a whole lot of people who you didn't know and didn't have anything to do with, but who would get or not get a job based on how you were doing. So not only was I doing well for me, but my doing well, I knew, helped somebody else. So there was that extra burden, which was unfortunate because it should be more just do the job and do it well. And pretty soon I got to the point where it was just about doing the job and doing it well and letting people decide what that looked like. But we were very aware of that, particularly in the 80s after Janet Cook made up a story at the Washington Post and won a Pulitzer for, and they had to give it back. And black reporters around the country were questioned about their work.
Yes. Well, times are different.
Very different now.
Huzzah. Hooray.
Yes.
I am so glad that you both found time to come in here and sit in our little studio and kind of let people get to know these two remarkable women that I'm proud to call colleagues and even happier that I can call friends. And I want to thank you so much for being part of my dream dinner conversation.
I am so glad that we got to be here, even if there is no Cabernet. This was absolutely worth it.
Thank you.
And I can't leave without saying thank you, not just for all you've done through the years, but for the times that I've had conversations with you here that have made a difference in how people saw me. So I love you.
Love you guys too. Thank you. Tomorrow is
is my last day hosting Stateside, so we'll have a little bit of a celebration of my 40 years on the air. I'll speak with a couple of my favorite Michigan writers about finding new meaning in new phases of life.
And I think it's telling that I left the practice of law. I did not go to a different law firm or do something different in law. Like, I completely walked away from it. And I just woke up one day and said, what's a good girl like me doing in a place like this?
And I'll talk with some old friends about how radio has changed through the years. And that includes a special visit from my good friend and radio mentor, Jim Harper.
People don't, I think, realize that you were actually the first woman to be the part of a morning radio show in a big city, anywhere.
Join me as I bid you farewell and wrap up my career on radio and television tomorrow on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber-Davis, and Adam Reyes. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.